a silver profile. He closed his fingers over the coin, held it tightly. He wondered if he'd get to be one of those guys who got life for something they didn't do. If he even made it that far. From what he'd seen of Mr. World and Mr. Town, they would have little trouble pulling him out of the system. Perhaps he'd suffer an unfortunate accident on the way to the next holding facility. He could be shot while making a break for it. It didn't seem at all unlikely. There was a stir of activity in the room on the other side of the glass. Officer Liz came back in. She pressed a button. A door that Shadow could not see opened, and a black deputy in a brown sheriff's uniform entered and walked briskly over to the desk. Shadow slipped the dollar coin back into his sock. The new deputy handed over some papers. Liz scanned them and signed. Chad Mulligan came in, said a few words to the new man, then he unlocked the cell door and walked inside. "Okay. Folk are here to pick you up. Seems you're a matter of national security, you know that?" "It'll make a great front-page story for the Lakeside News," said Shadow. Chad looked at him without expression. "That a drifter got picked up for parole violations? Not much of a story." "So that's the way it is?" "That's what they tell me," said Chad Mulligan. Shadow put his hands in front of him this time, and Chad cuffed him. Chad locked on the ankle hobbles and a rod from the cuffs to the hobbles. Shadow thought, "They'll take me outside. Maybe I can make a break for it. In hobbles and cuffs and lightweight orange clothes out into the snow." And even as he thought it, he knew how stupid and hopeless it was. Chad walked him out into the office. Liz had turned the TV off now. The black deputy looked him over. "He's a big guy," he said to Chad. Liz passed the new deputy the paper bag with Shadow's possessions in it, and he signed for it. Chad looked at Shadow, then at the deputy. He said to the deputy, quietly, but loudly enough for Shadow to hear, "Look, I just want to say, I'm not comfortable with the way this is happening." The deputy nodded. "You'll have to take it up with the appropriate authorities, sir. Our job is simply to bring him in." Chad made a sour face. He turned to Shadow. "Okay," said Chad. "Through that door and into the sally port." "What?" "Out there where the car is." Liz unlocked the doors. "You make sure that orange uniform comes right back here," she said to the deputy. "The last felon we sent down to Lafayette, we never saw the uniform again. They cost the county money." They walked Shadow out to the sally port, where a car sat idling. It wasn't a sheriff's department car, it was a black town car. Another deputy, a grizzled white guy with a mustache, stood by the car, smoking a cigarette. He crushed it out underfoot as they came close and opened the back door for Shadow. Shadow sat down awkwardly, his movements hampered by the cuffs and the hobble. There was no grill between the back and the front of the car. The two deputies climbed into the front of the car. The black deputy started the motor. They waited for the sally port door to open. "Come on, come on," said the black deputy, his fingers drumming against the steering wheel. Chad Mulligan tapped on the side window. The white deputy glanced at the driver, then he lowered the window. "This is wrong," said Chad. "I just wanted to say that." "Your comments have been noted and will be conveyed to the appropriate authorities," said the driver. The doors to the outside world opened. The snow was still falling, dizzying into the car's headlights. The driver put his foot on the gas, and they were heading back down the street and onto Main Street. "You heard about Wednesday?" said the driver. His voice sounded different now, older and familiar. "He's dead." "Yeah, I know," said Shadow. "I saw it on TV." "Those fuckers," said the white officer. It was the first thing he had said, and his voice was rough and accented, and, like the driver's, it was a voice that Shadow knew. "I tell you, they are fuckers, those fuckers." "Thanks for coming to get me," said Shadow.
"Don't mention it,"
said the driver. In the light of an oncoming car, his face already seemed to look older. He looked smaller, too. The last time Shadow had seen him, he had been wearing lemon-yellow gloves and a check jacket.
"We were in Milwaukee. Had to drive like demons when Ibis called. You think we'll let them lock you up and send you to the chair when I'm still waiting to break your head with my hammer?
asked the white deputy gloomily, fumbling in his pocket for a pack of cigarettes.
His accent was Eastern European.
"The real shit will hit the fan in an hour or less," said Mr. Nancy, looking more like himself with each moment. "When they really turn up to collect you, we'll pull over before we get to Highway 53 and get you out of those shackles and back into your own clothes."
Chernobog held up a handcuff key and smiled. "I like the mustache," said Shadow. "Suits you." Chernobog stroked it with a yellowed finger.
"Thank you."
"Wednesday," said Shadow. "Is he really dead? This isn't some kind of trick, is it?" He realized that he had been holding on to some kind of hope, foolish though it was. But the expression on Nancy's face told him all he needed to know. And the hope was gone.
Coming to America. 14,000 B.C. Cold it was, and dark, when the vision came to her, for in the far north, daylight was a gray, dim time in the middle of the day that came and went and came again, an interlude between darknesses. They were not a large tribe, as these things were counted then, nomads of the northern plains. They had a god, who was the skull of a mammoth, and the hide of a mammoth fashioned into a rough cloak. Nunyunini, they called him. When they were not traveling, he rested on a wooden frame at man height. She was the holy woman of the tribe, the keeper of its secrets, and her name was Atsula, the fox. Atsula walked before the two tribesmen who carried their god on long poles, draped with bear skins, that it should not be seen by profane eyes, nor at times when it was not holy. They roamed the tundra with their tents. The finest of the tents was made of caribou hide, and it was the holy tent, and there were four of them inside it, Atsula the priestess, Gugwe the tribal elder, Yanu the war leader, and Kalanu the scout. She called them there the day after she had her vision. Atsula scraped some lichen into the fire. Then she threw in dried leaves with her withered left hand. They smoked with an eye-stinging gray smoke, and gave off an odor that was sharp and strange. Then she took a wooden cup from the wooden platform, and she passed it to Gugwe. The cup was half-filled with a dark yellow liquid. Atsula had found the pung mushrooms, each with seven spots. Only a true holy woman could find a seven-spotted mushroom, and had picked them at the dark of the moon and dried them on a string of deer cartilage. Yesterday, before she slept, she had eaten the three dried mushroom caps. Her dreams had been confused and fearful things, of bright lights moving fast, of rock mountains filled with lights spearing upward like icicles. In the night she had woken, sweating, and needing to make water, she squatted over the wooden cup and filled it with her urine. Then she placed the cup outside the tent in the snow and returned to sleep. When she woke, she picked the lumps of ice out from the wooden cup, leaving a darker, more concentrated liquid behind. It was this liquid she passed around, first to Gugwe, then to Yanu and to Kalanu. Each of them took a large gulp of the liquid. Then Atsula took the final draft. She swallowed it and poured what was left on the ground in front of their god, a libation to Nunyunini. They sat in the smoky tent, waiting for their god to speak. Outside, in the darkness, the wind wailed and breathed. Kalanu, the scout, was a woman who dressed and walked as a man. She had even taken Dalani, a 14-year-old maiden, to be her wife. Kalanu blinked her eyes tightly, then she got up and walked over to the mammoth skull. She pulled the mammoth hide cloak over herself and stood so her head was inside the mammoth skull. "There is evil in the land," said Nunyunini in Kalanu's voice. "Evil such that if you stay here in the land of your mothers and your mothers' mothers, you shall all perish."
The three listeners grunted. "Is it the slavers, or the great wolves?" asked Gugwe, whose hair was long and white, and whose face was as wrinkled as the gray skin of a thorn tree. "It is not the slavers," said Nunyunini, old Stonehide. "It is not the great wolves." "Is it a famine? Is a famine coming?" asked Gugwe. Nunyunini was silent. Kalanu came out of the skull and waited with the rest of them. Gugwe put on the mammoth hide cloak and put his head inside the skull. "It is not a famine as you know it," said Nunyunini through Gugwe's mouth, "although a famine will follow." "Then what is it?" asked Yanu. "I am not afraid. I will stand against it. We have spears, and we have throwing rocks. Let 100 mighty warriors come against us. Still we shall prevail. We shall lead them into the marshes and split their skulls with our flints." "It is not a man thing," said Nunyunini, in Gugwe's old voice. "It will come from the skies, and none of your spears or your rocks will protect you."
"How can we protect ourselves?" asked Atsula. "I have seen flames in the skies. I have heard a noise louder than 10 thunderbolts. I have seen forests flattened and rivers boil."
"I," said Nunyunini, but he said no more. Gugwe came out of the skull, bending stiffly, for he was an old man, and his knuckles were swollen and knotted. There was silence. Atsula threw more leaves on the fire, and the smoke made their eyes tear. Then Yanu strode to the mammoth head, put the cloak about his broad shoulders, put his head inside the skull. His voice boomed. "You must journey," said Nunyunini. "You must travel to sunward. Where the sun rises, there you will find a new land where you will be safe. It will be a long journey. The moon will swell and empty, die and live twice. And there will be slavers and beasts, but I shall guide you and keep you safe if you travel toward the sunrise." Atsula spat on the mud of the floor and said, "No." She could feel the god staring at her. "No," she said. "You are a bad god to tell us this. We will die. We will all die, and then who will be left to carry you from high place to high place, to raise your tent, to oil your great tusks with fat?" The god said nothing. Atsula and Yanu exchanged places. Atsula's face stared out through the yellowed mammoth bone.
"Atsula has no faith," said Nunyunini in Atsula's voice. "Atsula shall die before the rest of you enter the new land, but the rest of you shall live. Trust me. There is a land to the east that is manless. This land shall be your land, and the land of your children and your children's children, for 7 generations and 7 sevens. But for Atsula's faithlessness, you would have kept it forever. In the morning, pack your tents and your possessions, and walk toward the sunrise."
And Gugwe and Yanu and Kalanu bowed their heads and exclaimed at the power and wisdom of Nunyunini. The moon swelled and swelled and waned once more. The people of the tribe walked east toward the sunrise, struggling through the icy winds which numbed their exposed skin. Nunyunini had promised them truly. They lost no one from the tribe on the journey, save for a woman in childbirth. And women in childbirth belong to the moon, not to Nunyunini. They crossed the land bridge. Kalanu had left them at first light to scout the way. Now the sky was dark, and Kalanu had not returned. But the night sky was alive with lights, knotting and flickering and winding, flux and pulse, white and green and violet and red. Atsula and her people had seen the northern lights before, but they were still frightened by them. And this was a display like they had never seen before. Kalanu returned to them as the lights in the sky formed and flowed.
"Sometimes," she said to Atsula, "I feel that I could simply spread my arms and fall into the sky." "That is because you are a scout," said Atsula, the priestess. "When you die, You shall fall into the sky and become a star to guide us as you guide us in life.
There are cliffs of ice to the east. High cliffs, said Kalanu, her raven black hair worn long as a man would wear it. We can climb them, but it will take many days.
You shall lead us safely, said Atsula. I shall die at the foot of the cliff, and that shall be the sacrifice that takes you into the new lands.
To the west of them, back in the lands from which they had come, where the sun had set hours before, there was a flash of sickly yellow light, brighter than lightning, brighter than daylight. It was a burst of pure brilliance that forced the folk on the land bridge to cover their eyes and spit and exclaim. Children began to wail.
That is the doom that Nunyunini warned us of, said Gugwe the old. Surely he is a wise god and a mighty one.
He is the best of all gods, said Kalanu. In our new land we shall raise him up on high, and we shall polish his tusks and skull with fish oil and animal fat, and we shall tell our children and our children's children and our seventh children's children that Nunyunini is the mightiest of all gods and shall never be forgotten.
Gods are great, said Atsula slowly, as if she were imparting a great secret. But the heart is greater, for it is from our hearts they come, and to our hearts they shall return.
And there is no telling how long she might have continued in this blasphemy, had it not been interrupted in a manner that brooked no argument. The roar that erupted from the west was so loud that ears bled, that they could hear nothing for some time, temporarily blinded and deafened, but alive, knowing that they were luckier than the tribes to the west of them.
It is good, said Atsula,
but she could not hear the words inside her head. Atsula died at the foot of the cliffs when the spring sun was at its zenith. She did not live to see the new world, and the tribe walked into those lands with no holy woman. They scaled the cliffs, and they went south and west until they found a valley with fresh water and rivers that teemed with silver fish and deer that had never seen man before and were so tame it was necessary to spit and to apologize to their spirits before killing them. Delaney gave birth to three boys, and some said that Kalanu had performed the final magic and could do the man thing with her bride, while others said that old Gugwe was not too old to keep a young bride company when her husband was away. And, certainly, once Gugwe died, Delaney had no more children. And the ice times came, and the ice times went, and the people spread out across the land and formed new tribes and chose new totems. Ravens and foxes and ground sloths and great cats and buffalo, each a beast that marked a tribe's identity, each beast a god. The mammoths of the new lands were bigger and slower and more foolish than the mammoth of the Siberian plains. And the pung mushrooms, with their seven spots, were not to be found in the new lands. And Nunyunini did not speak to the tribe any longer. And in the days of the grandchildren of Delaney and Kalanu's grandchildren, a band of warriors, members of a big and prosperous tribe, returning from a slaving expedition in the north to their home in the south, found the Valley of the First People. They killed most of the men, and they took the women and many of the children captive. One of the children, hoping for clemency, took them to a cave in the hills, in which they found a mammoth skull, the tattered remnants of a mammoth skin cloak, a wooden cup, and the preserved head of Atsula, the oracle. While some of the warriors of the new tribe were for taking the sacred objects away with them, stealing the gods of the first people and owning their power, others counseled against it. saying that they would bring nothing but ill luck and the malice of their own god. For these were the people of a raven tribe, and ravens are jealous gods. So they threw the objects down the side of the hill, into a deep ravine, and took the survivors of the first people with them on their long journey south. And the raven tribes and the fox tribes grew more powerful in the land. And soon Nunyunini was entirely forgot. Part 3. The Moment of the Storm. Chapter 14. People are in the dark. They don't know what to do. Had a little lantern. Oh, but it got blown out, too. I'm reaching out my hand. I hope you are, too. I just want to be in the dark with you. Greg Brown, In the Dark with You. They changed cars at 5 a.m. in Minneapolis, in the airport's long-term parking lot. They drove to the top floor, where the parking building was open to the sky. Shadow took the orange uniform and the handcuffs and leg hobbles, put them in the brown paper bag that had briefly held his possessions, folded the whole thing up and dropped it into a garbage can. They'd been waiting for 10 minutes when a barrel-chested young man came out of an airport door and walked over to them. He was eating a packet of Burger King French fries. Shadow recognized him immediately. He had sat in the back of the car when they had left the house on the rock and hummed so deeply the car had vibrated. He now sported a white-streaked winter beard he had not had before. It made him look older. The man wiped the grease from his hands onto his jeans, extended one huge hand to Shadow. "I heard of the All-Father's death," he said. "They will pay, and they will pay dearly." "Wednesday was your father?" asked Shadow. "He was the All-Father," said the man, his deep voice caught in his throat. "You tell them, all, that when we are needed, my people will be there." Chernobog picked at a flake of tobacco from between his teeth and spat it out onto the frozen slush. "And how many of you is that? 10, 20? The barrel-chested man's beard bristled. "And aren't 10 of us worth 100 of them? Who would stand against even one of my folk in a battle? But there are more of us than that at the edge of the cities. There are a few in the mountains, some in the Catskills, a few living in the Kearney towns in Florida. They keep their axes sharp. They will come if I call them."
"You do that, Elvis," said Mr. Nancy.
Shadow thought he said Elvis anyway. Nancy had exchanged the deputy's uniform for a thick brown cardigan, corduroy trousers, and brown loafers.
"You call them. It's what the old bastard would have wanted."
"They betrayed him. They killed him. I laughed at Wednesday, but I was wrong. None of us are safe any longer,"
said the man whose name sounded like Elvis.
"But you can rely on us."
He gently patted Shadow on the back and almost sent him sprawling. It was like being gently patted on the back by a wrecking ball. Chernobog had been looking around the parking lot. Now he said,
"You will pardon me asking, but our new vehicle is which?"
The barrel-chested man pointed. "There she is," he said. Chernobog snorted.
"That?"
It was a 1970 VW bus. There was a rainbow decal in the rear window.
"It's a fine vehicle, and it's the last thing that they'll be expecting you to be driving."
Chernobog walked around the vehicle. Then he started to cough, a lung-rumbling, old-man, 5 a.m. smoker's cough. He hawked and spat and put his hand to his chest, massaging away the pain.
"Yes, the last car they will suspect. So what happens when the police pull us over looking for the hippies and the dope, eh? We are not here to ride the magic bus. We are to blend in."
The bearded man unlocked the door of the bus.
"So they take a look at you, they see you aren't hippies, they wave you goodbye. It's the perfect disguise, and it's all I could find at no notice."
Chernobog seemed to be ready to argue it further, but Mr. Nancy intervened smoothly.
"Elvis, you come through for us. We are very grateful. Now that car needs to get back to Chicago."
"We'll leave it in Bloomington," said the bearded man. "The wolves will take care of it. Don't give it another thought." He turned back to Shadow. "Again you have my sympathy, and I share your pain. Good luck. And if the vigil falls to you, my admiration and my sympathy." He squeezed Shadow's hand with his own catcher's mitt fist. It hurt.
"You tell his corpse when you see it. Tell him that Alvis, son of Vindalf, will keep the faith."
The VW bus smelled of patchouli, of old incense and rolling tobacco. There was a faded pink carpet glued to the floor and to the walls. "Who was that?" asked Shadow, as he drove them down the ramp, grinding the gears.
"Just like he said, Alvis, son of Vindalf. He's the king of the dwarfs, the biggest, mightiest, greatest of all the dwarf folk."
"But he's not a dwarf," pointed out Shadow. "He's what, 5'8", 5'9"?
"Which makes him a giant among dwarfs," said Chernobog from behind him. "Tallest dwarf in America."
"What was that about the vigil?" asked Shadow. The two old men said nothing. Shadow glanced at Mr. Nancy, who was staring out of the window. "Well, he was talking about a vigil. You heard him." Chernobog spoke up from the back seat.
"You will not have to do it," he said.
"Do what?"
"The vigil. He talks too much. All the dwarfs talk and talk. He's nothing to think of. Better you put it out of your mind."
Driving south was like driving forward in time. The snows erased slowly and were completely gone by the following morning when the bus reached Kentucky. Winter was already over in Kentucky, and spring was on its way. Shadow began to wonder if there was some kind of equation to explain it. Perhaps every 50 miles he drove south, he was driving a day into the future. He would have mentioned his idea, but Mr. Nancy was asleep in the passenger seat in the front, while Chernobog snored unceasingly in the back. Time seemed a flexible construct at that moment, an illusion he was imagining as he drove. He found himself becoming painfully aware of birds and animals. He saw the crows on the side of the road, or in the bus's path, picking at roadkill. Flights of birds wheeled across the skies in patterns that almost made sense. Cats stared at them from front lawns and fence posts. Chernobog snorted and woke, sitting up slowly.
"I dreamed a strange dream," he said. "I dreamed that I am truly Bjellibok, that forever the world imagines that there are two of us, the light god and the dark, but that now we are both old. I find it was only me all the time, giving them gifts, taking my gifts away."
He broke the filter from a lucky strike, put it between his lips and lit it. Shadow wound down his window. "Aren't you worried about lung cancer?" he said.
"I am cancer," said Chernobog. "I do not frighten myself."
Nancy spoke.
"Folk like us don't get cancer. We don't get arteriosclerosis or Parkinson's disease or syphilis. We're kind of hard to kill."
"They killed Wednesday," said Shadow. He pulled over for gas and then parked next door at a restaurant for an early breakfast. As they entered, the payphone in the entrance began to jangle. They gave their orders to an elderly woman with a worried smile who had been sitting reading a paperback copy of What My Heart Meant by Jenny Curtin. The woman sighed, then walked back and over to the phone, picked it up, said,
"Yes."
Then she looked back at the room, said,
"Yep, looks like they are. You just hold the line now,"
and walked over to Mr. Nancy.
"It's for you,"
she said.
"Okay,"
said Mr. Nancy.
"Now, ma'am, you make sure those fries are real crisp now. Think burnt."
He walked over to the payphone.
"This is he." "And what makes you think I'm dumb enough to trust you?" he said. "I can find it," he said. "I know where it is." "Yes," he said. "Of course we want it."
You know we want it, and I know you want to get rid of it, so don't give me any shit.
He hung up the telephone, came back to the table.
Who was it? Asked Shadow.
Didn't say.
What do they want?
They were offering us a truce while they hand over the body.
They lie, said Chernobog. They want to lure us in, and then they will kill us. What they did to Wednesday is what I always used to do, he added, with gloomy pride.
It's on neutral territory, said Nancy. Truly neutral.
Chernobog chuckled. It sounded like a metal ball rattling in a dry skull.
I used to say that also. Come to a neutral place, I would say, and then in the night we would rise up and kill them all. Those were the good days.
Mr. Nancy shrugged. He crunched down on his dark brown French fries, grinned his approval.
These are fine fries, he said.
We can't trust those people, said Shadow.
Listen, I'm older than you, and I'm smarter than you, and I'm better looking than you, said Mr. Nancy,
thumping the bottom of the ketchup bottle, blobbing ketchup over his burnt fries.
I can get more pussy in an afternoon than you'll get in a year. I can dance like an angel, fight like a cornered bear, plan better than a fox, sing like a nightingale.
And your point here is? Nancy's brown eyes gazed into Shadow's.
And they need to get rid of the body as much as we need to take it.
Chernobog said,
There is no such neutral place.
There's one, said Mr. Nancy. It's the center.
Determining the exact center of anything can be problematic at best. With living things, people, for example, or continents, the problem becomes one of intangibles. What is the center of a man? What is the center of a dream? And in the case of the continental United States, should one count Alaska when one attempts to find the center, or Hawaii? As the 20th century began, they made a huge model of the USA, the lower 48 states, out of cardboard, and to find the center they balanced it on a pin, until they found the single place it balanced. As near as anyone could figure it out, the exact center of the continental United States was several miles from Lebanon, Kansas, on Johnny Gribbs' hog farm. By the 1930s, the people of Lebanon were all ready to put a monument up in the middle of the hog farm, but Johnny Gribbs said that he didn't want millions of tourists coming in and tramping all over and upsetting the hogs. So they put the monument to the geographical center of the United States, 2 miles north of the town. They built a park and a stone monument to go in the park and a brass plaque on the monument. They blacktopped the road from the town, and, certain of the influx of tourists waiting to arrive, they even built a motel by the monument. Then they waited. The tourists did not come. Nobody came. It's a sad little park now, with a mobile chapel in it that wouldn't fit a small funeral party, and a motel whose windows look like dead eyes.
Which is why, concluded Mr. Nancy as they drove into Humansville, Missouri, population 1,084, the exact center of America is a tiny rundown park, an empty church, a pile of stones, and a derelict motel.
Hog farm, said Chernobog. You just said that the real center of America was a hog farm.
This isn't about what is, said Mr. Nancy. It's about what people think is. It's all imaginary, anyway. That's why it's important. People only fight over imaginary things.
My kind of people? Asked Shadow. Or your kind of people? Nancy said nothing. Chernobog made a noise that might have been a chuckle, might have been a snort. Shadow tried to get comfortable in the back of the bus. He had only slept a little. He had a bad feeling in the pit of his stomach, worse than the feeling he had had in prison, worse than the feeling he had had back when Laura had come to him and told him about the robbery. This was bad. The back of his neck prickled. He felt sick, and several times, in waves, he felt scared. Mr. Nancy pulled over in Humansville, parked outside a supermarket. Mr. Nancy went inside, and Shadow followed him in. Chernobog waited in the parking lot, smoking his cigarette.
there was a young, fair-haired man, little more than a boy, restocking the breakfast cereal shelves.
"Hey," said Mr. Nancy.
"Hey," said the young man.
"It's true, isn't it? They killed him."
"Yes," said Mr. Nancy. "They killed him."
The young man banged several boxes of Captain Crunch down on the shelf.
"They think they can crush us like cockroaches," he said.
He had a tarnished silver bracelet circling his wrist.
"We don't crush that easy, do we?"
"No,"
said Mr. Nancy.
"We don't."
"I'll be there, sir,"
said the young man, his pale blue eyes blazing.
"I know you will, Gwydion," said Mr. Nancy.
Mr. Nancy bought several large bottles of R.C. Cola, a six-pack of toilet paper, a pack of evil-looking black cigarillos, a bunch of bananas, and a pack of Doublemint chewing gum.
"He's a good boy. Came over in the 7th century. Welsh."
The bus meandered first to the west and then to the north. Spring faded back into the dead end of winter. Kansas was the cheerless gray of lonesome clouds, empty windows, and lost hearts. Shadow had become adept at hunting for radio stations, negotiating between Mr. Nancy, who liked talk radio and dance music, and Chernobog, who favored classical music, the gloomier the better, leavened with the more extreme evangelical religious stations. For himself, Shadow liked oldies. Toward the end of the afternoon, they stopped, at Chernobog's request, on the outskirts of Cherryvale, Kansas, population 2,464. Chernobog led them to a meadow outside the town. There were still traces of snow in the shadows of the trees, and the grass was the color of dirt.
"Wait here," said Chernobog.
He walked, alone, to the center of the meadow. He stood there in the winds of the end of February for some time. At first he hung his head, then he began gesticulating.
"He looks like he's talking to someone," said Shadow. "Ghosts," said Mr. Nancy. "They worshipped him here over 100 years ago. They made blood sacrifice to him, libations spilled with the hammer. After a time, the townsfolk figured out why so many of the strangers who passed through the town didn't ever come back. This was where they hid some of the bodies."
Chernobog came back from the middle of the field. His mustache seemed darker now, and there were streaks of black in his gray hair. He smiled, showing his iron tooth.
"I feel good now. Ah, some things linger, and blood lingers longest."
They walked back across the meadow to where they had parked the VW bus. Chernobog lit a cigarette, but didn't cough.
"They did it with the hammer," he said. "Wotan, he would talk of the gallows and the spear, but for me it is one thing."
He reached out a nicotine-colored finger and tapped it hard in the center of Shadow's forehead.
"Please don't do that," said Shadow politely.
"Please don't do that," mimicked Chernobog. "One day I will take my hammer and do much worse than that to you, my friend, remember?"
"Yes," said Shadow. "But if you tap my head again, I'll break your hand." Chernobog snorted. Then he said,
"They should be grateful, the people here. There was such power raised, even 30 years after they forced my people into hiding. This land, this very land, gave us the greatest movie star of all time. She was the greatest there ever was."
"Judy Garland?" asked Shadow. Chernobog shook his head curtly.
"He's talking about Louise Brooks," said Mr. Nancy.
Shadow decided not to ask who Louise Brooks was. Instead, he said, "So look, when Wednesday went to talk to them, he did it under a truce."
"Yes."
"And now we're going to get Wednesday's body from them as a truce."
"Yes."
"And we know that they want me dead or out of the way."
"They want all of us dead," said Nancy.
"So what I don't get is, why do we think they'll play fair this time, when they didn't for Wednesday?"
"That," said Chernobog, "is why we are meeting at the center. Is," he frowned, "what is the word for it, the opposite of sacred?"
"Profane," said Shadow, without thinking.
"No," said Chernobog, "I mean when a place is less sacred than any other place, of negative sacredness. Places where they can build no temples, Places where people will not come and will leave as soon as they can. Places where gods only walk if they are forced to.
I don't know, said Shadow. I don't think there's a word for it.
All of America has it, a little, said Chernobog. That is why we are not welcome here.
But the center, said Chernobog, the center is worst. It's like a minefield. We all tread too carefully there to dare break the truce.
They had reached the bus. Chernobog patted Shadow's upper arm.
You don't worry, he said with gloomy reassurance. Nobody else is going to kill you. Nobody but me.
This ends Disc 13. American Gods, Disc 14.
Shadow found the center of America at evening that same day before it was fully dark. It was on a slight hill to the northwest of Lebanon. He drove around the little hillside park, past the tiny mobile chapel and the stone monument, and when Shadow saw the one-story 1950s motel at the edge of the park, his heart sank. There was a black Humvee parked in front of it. It looked like a jeep reflected in a funhouse mirror, as squat and pointless and ugly as an armored car. There were no lights on inside the building. They parked beside the motel, and as they did so, a man in a chauffeur's uniform and cap walked out of the motel and was illuminated by the headlights of the bus. He touched his cap to them politely, got into the Humvee, and drove off.
Big car, Tiny Dick, said Mr. Nancy.
Do you think they'll even have beds here? Asked Shadow. It's been days since I slept in a bed. This place looks like it's just waiting to be demolished.
It's owned by hunters from Texas, said Mr. Nancy. Come up here once a year. Damned if I know what they're hunting. It stops the place being condemned and destroyed.
They climbed out of the bus. Waiting for them in front of the motel was a woman Shadow did not recognize. She was perfectly made up, perfectly coiffed. She reminded him of every newscaster he'd ever seen on morning television, sitting in a studio that didn't really resemble a living room.
"Lovely to see you," she said. "Now you must be Chernobog. I've heard a lot about you. And you're Anansi, always up to mischief, eh? You jolly old man. And you must be Shadow. You've certainly led us a merry chase, haven't you?"
A hand took his, pressed it firmly, looked him straight in the eye.
"I'm Media. Good to meet you. I hope we can get this evening's business done as pleasantly as possible."
The main doors opened.
"Somehow, Toto," said the fat kid Shadow had last seen sitting in a limo, "I don't believe we're in Kansas anymore." "We're in Kansas," said Mr. Nancy. "I think we must have drove through most of it today. Damn, but this country is flat." "This place has no lights, no power, and no hot water," said the fat kid. "And no offense, you people really need the hot water. You just smell like you've been in that bus for a week."
"I don't think there's any need to go there," said the woman smoothly. "We're all friends here. Come on in, we'll show you to your rooms." "We took the first four rooms. Your late friend is in the fifth. All the ones beyond room 5 are empty. You can take your pick. I'm afraid it's not the Four Seasons, but then, what is?"
She opened the door to the motel lobby for them. It smelled of mildew, of damp and dust and decay. There was a man sitting in the lobby in the near darkness.
"You people hungry?" he asked.
"I can always eat," said Mr. Nancy.
"Driver's gone out for a sack of hamburgers," said the man. "He'll be back soon."
He looked up. It was too dark to see faces, but he said,
"Big guy, you're Shadow, huh? The asshole who killed Woody and Stone?"
"No," said Shadow. "That was someone else. And I know who you are."
He did. He had been inside the man's head.
"Your town. Have you slept with Wood's widow yet?" Mr. Town fell off his chair.
In a movie, it would have been funny. In real life, it was simply clumsy. He stood up quickly, came toward Shadow. Shadow looked down at him and said, "Don't start anything you're not prepared to finish." Mr. Nancy rested his hand on Shadow's upper arm. "Truce, remember?" he said. "We're at the center." Mr. Town turned away, leaned over to the counter, and picked up three keys. "You're down at the end of the hall," he said. "Here." He handed the keys to Mr. Nancy and walked away into the shadows of the corridor. They heard a motel room door open, and they heard it slam. Mr. Nancy passed a key to Shadow, another to Chernobog. "Is there a flashlight on the bus?" asked Shadow.
"No," said Mr. Nancy, "but it's just dark. You mustn't be afraid of the dark."
"I'm not," said Shadow. "I'm afraid of the people in the dark."
"Dark is good," said Chernobog.
He seemed to have no difficulty seeing where he was going, leading them down the darkened corridor, putting the keys into the locks without fumbling.
"I will be in room 10, he told them, and then he said, "Media, I think I have heard of her. Isn't she the one who killed her children?"
"Different woman," said Mr. Nancy. "Same deal."
Mr. Nancy was in room 8, and Shadow opposite the two of them in room 9. The room smelled damp and dusty and deserted. There was a bed frame in there with a mattress on it, but no sheets. A little light entered the room from the gloaming outside the window. Shadow sat down on the mattress, pulled off his shoes, and stretched out at full length. He had driven too much in the last few days. Perhaps he slept. He was walking. A cold wind tugged at his clothes. The tiny snowflakes were little more than a crystalline dust which gusted and flurried in the wind. There were trees, bare of leaves in the winter. There were high hills on each side of him. It was late on a winter's afternoon. The sky and the snow had attained the same deep shade of purple. Somewhere ahead of him, in this light, distances were impossible to judge, the flames of a bonfire flickered, yellow and orange. A gray wolf padded through the snow before him. Shadow stopped. The wolf stopped also, and turned, and waited. One of its eyes glinted yellowish-green. Shadow shrugged and walked toward the flames, and the wolf ambled ahead of him. The bonfire burned in the middle of a grove of trees. There must have been 100 trees planted in 2 rows. There were shapes hanging from the trees. At the end of the rows was a building that looked a little like an overturned boat. It was carved of wood, and it crawled with wooden creatures and wooden faces, dragons, griffins, trolls, and boars, all of them dancing in the flickering light of the fire. The bonfire was so high that Shadow could barely approach it. The wolf padded around the crackling fire. In place of the wolf, a man came out on the other side of the fire. He was leaning on a tall stick.
"You are in Uppsala in Sweden," said the man in a familiar, gravelly voice, "about 1,000 years ago."
"Wednesday?" said Shadow.
The man continued to talk as if Shadow was not there.
"First every year, then later when the rot set in and they became lax, every 9 years they would sacrifice here. A sacrifice of 9s. Each day for 9 days they would hang 9 animals from trees in the grove. One of those animals was always a man."
He strode away from the firelight toward the trees, and Shadow followed him. As he approached the trees, the shapes that hung from them resolved, legs and eyes and tongues and heads. Shadow shook his head. There was something about seeing a bull hanging by its neck from a tree that was darkly sad, and at the same time surreal enough almost to be funny. Shadow passed a hanging stag, a wolfhound, a brown bear, and a chestnut horse with a white mane, little bigger than a pony. The dog was still alive. Every few seconds it would kick spasmodically, and it was making a strained, whimpering noise as it dangled from the rope. The man he was following took his long stick, which Shadow realized now, as it moved, was actually a spear, and he slashed at the dog's stomach with it. In one knife-like cut, downward. Steaming entrails tumbled onto the snow.
"I dedicate this death to Odin,"
said the man formally. "It's only a gesture," he said, turning back to Shadow, "but gestures mean everything. The death of one dog symbolizes the death of all dogs. 9 men they gave to me, but they stood for all the men, all the blood, all the power. It just wasn't enough. One day the blood stopped flowing. Belief without blood only takes us so far. The blood must flow."
"I saw you die," said Shadow.
"In the god business," said the figure, and now Shadow was certain it was Wednesday, nobody else had that rasp, that deep, cynical joy in words, "it's not the death that matters, it's the opportunity for resurrection. And when the blood flows..." He gestured at the animals, at the people hanging from the trees. Shadow couldn't decide whether the dead humans they walked past were more or less horrifying than the animals. At least the humans had known the fate they were going to. There was a deep, boozy smell about the men that suggested that they had been allowed to anesthetize themselves on their way to the gallows, while the animals would simply have been lynched, hauled up alive and terrified. The faces of the men looked so young. None of them was older than 20. "Who am I?" asked Shadow.
"You," said the man, "you were an opportunity. You were part of a grand tradition, although both of us are committed enough to the affair to die for it, eh?"
"Who are you?" asked Shadow.
"The hardest part is simply surviving," said the man.
The bonfire, and Shadow realized with a strange horror that it truly was a bone fire. Rib cages and fire-eyed skulls stared and stuck and jutted from the flames, sputtering trace element colors into the night, greens and yellows and blues, was flaring and crackling and burning hotly. 3 days on the tree, 3 days in the underworld, 3 days to find my way back. The flames sputtered and flamed too brightly for Shadow to look at directly. He looked down into the darkness beneath the trees. A knock on the door. And now there was moonlight coming in the window. Shadow sat up with a start.
"Dinner served," said Media's voice.
Shadow put his shoes back on, walked over to the door, went out into the corridor. Someone had found some candles, and a dim yellow light illuminated the reception hall. The driver of the Humvee came in holding a cardboard tray and a paper sack. He wore a long black coat and a peaked chauffeur's cap.
"Sorry about the delay," he said hoarsely. "I got everybody the same, a couple of burgers, large fries, large Coke and apple pie. I'll eat mine out in the car."
He put the food down, then walked back outside. The smell of fast food filled the lobby. Shadow took the paper bag and passed out the food, the napkins, the packets of ketchup. They ate in silence while the candles flickered and the burning wax hissed. Shadow noticed that Town was glaring at him. He turned his chair a little so his back was to the wall. Media ate her burger with a napkin poised by her lips to remove crumbs.
"Oh, great, these burgers are nearly cold," said the fat kid.
He was still wearing his shades, which Shadow thought pointless and foolish, given the darkness of the room.
"Sorry about that," said Town. "The nearest McDonald's is in Nebraska."
They finished their lukewarm hamburgers and cold fries. The fat kid bit into his single-person apple pie, and the filling spurted down his chin. Unexpectedly, the filling was still hot.
"Ow!" he said.
He wiped at it with his hand, licking his fingers to get them clean.
"That stuff burns," he said. "Those pies are a class action suit waiting to fucking happen."
Shadow wanted to hit the kid. He'd wanted to hit him since the kid had his goons hurt him in the limo after Laura's funeral. He pushed the thought away. "Can't we just take Wednesday's body and get out of here?" he asked.
"Midnight,"
said Mr. Nancy, and the fat kid at the same time.
"These things must be done by the rules," said Chernobog.
"Yeah," said Shadow, "but nobody tells me what they are. You keep talking about the goddamn rules. I don't even know what game you people are playing."
"It's like breaking the street date," said Media, brightly. "You know, when things are allowed to be on sale."
Town said, I think the whole thing's a crock of shit. But if their rules make them happy, then my agency is happy, and everybody's happy. He slurped his coke. Roll on, Midnight. You take the body, you go away. We're all lovey-fucking-dovey, and we wave you goodbye, and then we can get on with hunting you down like the rats you are.
Hey, said the fat kid to Shadow, reminds me, I told you to tell your boss he was history. Did you ever tell him?
I told him, said Shadow. And you know what he said to me? He said to tell the little snot, if ever I saw him again, to remember that today's future is tomorrow's yesterday. Wednesday had never said any such thing. Still, these people seemed to like clichés. The black sunglasses reflected the flickering candle flames back at him like eyes. The fat kid said,
This place is such a fucking dump, no power. Out of wireless range, I mean. When you gotta be wired, you're already back in the Stone Age.
He sucked the last of his coke through the straw, dropped the cup on the table, and walked away down the corridor. Shadow reached over and placed the fat kid's garbage back into the paper sack. I'm going to see the center of America, he announced. He got up and walked outside into the night. Mr. Nancy followed him. They strolled together across the little park, saying nothing until they reached the stone monument. The wind gusted at them, fitfully, first from one direction, then from another. So, he said, now what? The half-moon hung pale in the dark sky.
Now, said Nancy, you should go back to your room. Lock the door. You try to get some more sleep. At midnight they give us the body, and then we get the hell out of here. The center is not a stable place for anybody.
If you say so. Mr. Nancy inhaled on his cigarillo.
This should never have happened, he said. None of this should have happened. Our kind of people, we are...
He waved the cigarillo about as if using it to hunt for a word, then stabbing forward with it.
Exclusive. We're not social, not even me, not even Bacchus, not for long. We walk by ourselves or we stay in our own little groups. We do not play well with others. We like to be adored and respected and worshipped. Me, I like them to be telling tales about me, tales showing my cleverness. It's a fault, I know, but it's the way I am. We like to be big. Now, in these shabby days, we are small. The new gods rise and fall and rise again. But this is not a country that tolerates gods for long. Brahma creates, Vishnu preserves, Shiva destroys, and the ground is clear for Brahma to create once more.
So what are you saying? Asked Shadow. The fighting's over now? The battle's done? Mr. Nancy snorted.
Are you out of your mind? They killed Wednesday. They killed him and they bragged about it. They spread the word. They've showed it on every channel to those with eyes to see it. No, Shadow, it's only just begun.
He bent down at the foot of the stone monument, stubbed out his cigarillo on the earth, and left it there like an offering. You used to make jokes, said Shadow. You don't anymore.
It's hard to find the jokes these days. Wednesday's dead. Are you coming inside?
Soon. Nancy walked away toward the motel. Shadow reached out his hand and touched the monument's stones. He dragged his big fingers across the cold brass plate, then he turned and walked over to the tiny white church, walked through the open doorway into the darkness. He sat down in the nearest pew and closed his eyes and lowered his head and thought about Laura and about Wednesday and about being alive. There was a click from behind him and a scuff of shoe against earth. Shadow sat up and turned. Someone stood just outside the open doorway, a dark shape against the stars. Moonlight glinted from something metal.
You going to shoot me? Asked Shadow.
Jesus, I wish, said Mr. Town. It's only for self-defense.
So you're praying? Have they got you thinking that they're gods? They aren't gods.
I wasn't praying, said Shadow. Just thinking.
The way I figure it, said Town, they're mutations. Evolutionary experiments, a little hypnotic ability, a little hocus-pocus, and they can make people believe anything. Nothing to write home about, that's all. They die like men, after all.
They always did, said Shadow.
He got up, and Town took a step back.
Shadow walked out of the little chapel, and Mr. Town kept his distance. "Hey," Shadow said, "do you know who Louise Brooks was?"
"Friend of yours?"
"Nope, she was a movie star from south of here." Town paused.
"Maybe she changed."